It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about sheep shearing ahead of lambs being born in the spring, and you can be part of the discussion about the industry around shorn wool. Call in with a question, share your comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Now to a family farm in Wisconsin where the craft of sheep shearing is passed from one generation to the next. Mackenzie Crummy reports.
Jerome Huber remembers the first time he sheared a sheep.
My first job out was 9 head for the neighbor and took me all afternoon.
Huber was 15 years old. Since he was too young for a driver's license, he had to get rides back and forth to jobs across south central Wisconsin. Today, Huber can shear the same number of sheep in less than 30 minutes. But while his skills have improved over the past 70 years, the demand for workers like him is much higher these days. Fewer people are becoming professional shearers in Wisconsin, where about 78,000 sheep and lambs live. Huber and his family are now rare specialists in the state's farming industry. Huber's sons and grandsons started shearing as teenagers like him. His adult son, Joe, has been shearing for 43 years.
I would say they're one of the probably the longest lasting or been in the business for as long as anybody in the state. As other shearers come and go, that family's been doing it for a long time.
That's Todd Taylor, a manager of the Sheep Research Unit for the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Taylor says the need for shearers is at an all-time high across the country.
There is a technique to it. It's not just lay a sheep down and start shearing. You know, there is a proper way to do it so that you can efficiently and safely get the wool off in one piece. You don't do any harm to the sheep.
At the Huber family farm in Oxford, several barns are filled with sheep, cattle, and equipment. The farmhouse has been in the family for generations. Jerome Huber was born in the bedroom where he sleeps today. In one barn, Joe Huber preps the family's shearing equipment as the sheep wait nearby.
These are our hand pieces that we shear with. We have different hand pieces. We have a quarter horse motor with a drop shaft to run the machines, and then we just plug our hand pieces into them.
The job requires a crew of people. A wrangler plucks sheep from the herd. A wool handler gathers and rolls the wool. The wool comes off the sheep in a single piece and weighs on average 5 to 15 pounds. Huber's son Joe is explaining the operation.
Breaking up through the neck. So this position here is the hardest position to learn how to hold the sheep. You know, he just went up through the line where he doesn't see his blade at all.
The Hubers and Taylors say sheep must be sheared. Less wool helps sheep deliver lambs in a more sanitary condition and makes it easier for lambs to feed from their mothers. The decline in professional sheep shears is partially driven by the difficulty of the job. According to the Hubers and Taylor, the work is physical and tough on the body. The Hubers sometimes leave jobs with bruises from being kicked by sheep. One grandson even blew out his knee. Today, Wisconsin is home to fewer wool-producing sheep than past decades. The U.S. Department of Agriculture says Wisconsin created nearly 590,000 pounds of wool in 1997. Last year, about 45% less wool came out of the state. Here's Jerome Huber.
Well, it's a generation now. Everybody's going to polyester clothes and everything, cotton. And wool costs a lot more for processing, and it costs the consumer more. Wool lasts so much longer.
Sheep shearing requires training and practice to become efficient. Taylor says the Hubers are masters of the trade. In February, Joe Huber traveled to shear a herd of 400 sheep with his two sons. They completed the job in 2 days, averaging 15 sheep an hour. Joe Huber won a national championship for sheep shearing in 1988. He now teaches an annual class for beginners in Arlington. He says the work should focus on quality, however, not speed.
Here in Wisconsin, what my dad taught me and I taught my sons and what I teach at shearing school, speed is not everything. Do a good job, and you don't want to nick them up, because a lot of sheep in Wisconsin are people's pets, and they don't. If you nick them up and cut them up or rough with them, you won't be back to shear their flock next year.
Joe Huber and Todd Taylor plan to teach the class again at the end of the year. Huber says 16 students typically sign up and maybe one or two go on to become shearers. But at the family barn on a recent Saturday, relatives and friends show up to watch the Hubers shear 90 head of sheep. It's like a party. Jerome Huber's great-grandkids are here, too.
How about you, dear? How old are you?
Five.
You're five? Are you going to shear sheep? Are you? The boy nods, drawing a smile from Jerome Huber.
I'm kind of proud about it. So, never thought it would be a business like this.
Mackenzie Crummy, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now we continue to explore the industry around Wisconsin-raised sheep and lambs with Heather Pierce, Wool Production Program Manager for the American Sheep Industry Association. You can call in with a question, share your thoughts at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Heather, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So we just heard up close and personal there one Wisconsin family's experiences in the industry. Can you explain what happens to wool after the fiber is removed by the shearers?
Sure. So they mentioned how after it's shorn, somebody takes that and handles the wool. So they take it over to a table oftentimes and take off some of the not so valuable parts of the wool. So maybe some of the shorter pieces or the really dirty pieces. And then that wool gets packaged. And then all of that wool is still raw wool. So it has lanolin in it and hay pieces and dirt. And so it needs to be processed. And that way it can make its way into a sweater or shirt or scarf, something like that. So it'll usually make its way to somewhere like a warehouse or wool pool that gathers more wool. And then it makes its way to a wool buyer. And that buyer will, again, gather more wool from different places, and so it has a larger load, and then sell it to a processor. And so, like I said, that wool is still really dirty, and it has all the lanolin in it, so it has to be washed. So that's the first stage in the processing, is being washed. And so the lanolin is really important. It'll be separated off, and it goes into cosmetics and lotions. And then the wool is dried. And at that point, it's kind of a mess. It's all, and not tangled, but it's just kind of a big mess. And so it has to be combed out and all those fibers going in the same direction.
And that's how you card the wool.
And then it can be spun into yarn. Uh-huh. So yes, yep, carded and combed out. Yep. And then it'll be spun into yarn. And then we need some way to get it actually into clothing from there. So it needs to go into fabric. And there's really two kind of main ways to get into fabric. And one of them is knitted. And so you can think of like a t-shirt that's knit and it's stretchier. And then all the other way is woven. And so that's a little bit more structured type of fabric. After that, that fabric will be cut and then sewn into the final product.
Is the price that farmers receive for wool different today compared to past decades? What is the marketplace like?
Yeah, so it's pretty rough right now. So wool is definitely a global commodity. It's grown and sold all over the world and processed all over the world. And you probably think of big wool places like Australia, and you would be right. Australia produces the most pounds of clean wool. And so really Australia prices set the foundation for our prices here in the U.S. And in especially the like 2018 and a little bit before that, prices are really good. Wool is having a great price time. But then after that, especially here in the U.S., we entered the U.S.-China trade war. And so we started seeing prices go down. And then COVID hit and everything stopped. So processing all over the world stopped. But sheep don't start up growing wool. It just keeps growing just like your hair does. And so with that, we've really seen an oversupply of wool now, and we're still working through that oversupply.
There was one major buyer near Wisconsin, the Mid-States Wool Growers Cooperative that was in Ohio, closed last year. How does the closing like a co-op like that affect the wool market for Midwest farmers?
And so part of it is that transportation is expensive. Just like for anything. And so when there's not a buyer in an area, it does make it more expensive and it's harder to find a buyer. So it's more expensive to transport it to them and it's harder to find a buyer. Luckily, there is still one not too far over the border in Illinois from Wisconsin, and that's Grunwald Fur and Wool. And they take, they're actually pretty unique. They work directly with shearers. And they'll, so the shearer goes out, shears somebody's sheep, and they'll actually pay them for their wool right then and there. And then the shearer takes the wool and takes it to Grunwald. And then that way they can gather more wool and market it.
Heather Pierce with us, the American Sheep Industry Association's Wool Production Program Manager, as we discuss the industry around shorn wool in Wisconsin. You can be part of the discussion. Call in with a question, share perspective, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As springtime is a typical season for shearing sheep, we explore aspects of production and the larger industry in Wisconsin as fleece moves through a process and becomes a clothing garment or another item using wool. Call in with a question. You can add comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. We have Heather Pierce with us, Wool Production Program Manager at the American Sheep Industry Association. Heather, you mentioned Australia kind of setting global market prices. The International Wool Textile Organization says Australia is the largest clean wool producing country, China being the largest greasy wool producing country. What is the distinction there between clean and greasy wool?
Yeah, so right, it's kind of surprising. You don't always think of China as having that many sheep. And so when we talk about wool, we usually sell it on a clean basis. So that's after it's been washed and that lanolin and dirt has all come out. And so Australia produces the most clean wool, then, so actually pounds of wool that has already been cleaned. And then China, it fluctuates year by year, but China produces a lot of wool in general. So, but when it's not washed, if you're looking at it on that basis, they produce sometimes more than even Australia.
And so wool that is not washed or sanitized in any way, that would be considered greasy wool?
Yeah, so all wool comes off greasy. It's raw wool right off the sheep. And then after that, it'll be cleaned. And so you can think about it, that raw greasy wool is a certain amount of weight. And then after you wash it, it'll lose roughly half of its weight.
So why has China become a leading exporter of wool in the past decade?
Yeah, so they produce a lot of wool. And part of it is that most of the processing in the world happens in China. And so they take their wool right from their own country and can process it. And then they also use a lot of that wool. So they are a very heavy user of wool products.
Let's take a call. Jerry in Kakana is here. Jerry, hi.
Yes. Can you talk about the differences between the alpaca and llama wool and how it compares to merino? And is there a difference in microns?
Jerry, thank you. Can you talk about those differences and specifically alpaca?
Sure. So alpaca is also a beautiful fiber. It doesn't have the lanolin that wool does. And so in terms of processing, it's maybe a little bit easier for small mills to process that fiber. Alpaca doesn't also always have the crimp that some wool has. So some wool is probably more crimpy than alpaca has, and that crimp really gives it more elasticity in a product and memory. And then in terms of micron, so when we're talking about that, all wool, whether it's alpaca or wool from sheep or alpacas, the fibers are measured in terms of microns. So that's actually how wide the individual fibers are. And alpaca tends to be fairly fine. A wool has a really broad range. So if we're talking about merino, it can be down into the teens, up to about 21, 22 microns. But then wool also goes up all the way into the 30 microns. And just for reference, human hair, say, is from usually about 50 to 100 microns. So definitely a lot coarser for human hair. But merino is fairly comparable to the alpaca in terms of micron.
Okay, so Jerry, thank you for that question. Later, we're going to talk to Wind Ridge Fiber Farm, where the farmer creates fiber from wool, sells it locally as yarn and other products. How common are hyper-local markets in the country?
Yeah, so even when I was growing up, there were definitely some around, some of those niche markets that sell yarn to hand spinners and other fiber artists. And since COVID, it's actually grown even more. So people stayed home and they learned how to knit. And so that market has grown even more since then.
We heard in the piece that, you know, there is an art to sheep shearing, and there's certainly a lot of mastery in the work as not to nick the animal or to cause pain. Is there any way for consumers to know if the fleece that eventually makes its way into clothing is harvested humanely?
So I would say on the very, very large, most everybody, they're around sheep every day. They care about sheep. And a farmer certainly doesn't want to see their animals being hurt. Nobody wants to see anything like that. So people take a lot of time and effort to learn how to shear properly. And they go to schools all over the U.S., like we talked about, to learn how to do that. So it's a profession, and they have training in that. And so people take a lot of care and a lot of pride in how they shear their sheep here.
Some industries, you know, see worker shortages, like healthcare. Is this particular very niche type of industry seeing a new generation of people who want to learn the art and mastery of shearing sheep?
Yeah, so there is definitely a shortage of shears here in the U.S. and even globally. But we are starting to see, there's always people here and there that are interested. Sometimes it's family members that that's what their family does, and that's great. And other times, there's certain places that maybe your friend does it, and so you tag along, and then you start to learn. Mm-hmm. And so it's somewhat random, but great that there you have the traditional sources and then new ones as well.
We have Heather Pierce with us from the American Sheep Industry Association as we talk about fleece that turns to wool and in the products that we use. Call in questions and comments about the process, 800-642-1234. Allison in Racine is here. Hi, Allison. Go ahead.
Hi. I was wondering how Italy factors into the wool market. I know they're renowned for textiles, and it's a historically an important industry in that country, and I'm just wondering how wool might fit in there.
Thanks, Allison. Yeah, what is the place of Italy and their wool, Heather?
So, absolutely. They definitely create very high-quality, high-end wool products still, and they have processing there. And so that is a very important place for wool to go when you're thinking about those high-end markets. And that ranges from the traditional high-end brands that you might think of to more of the even hand-knitting end as well.
You are noticing that wool pellets for gardening are gaining traction, gaining popularity. What do you see there with wool used in gardening?
Yes, so that one has really taken off lately. And so it's wool pellets are just raw wool, so still has that lanolin and everything in it, and it's compressed into a pellet. And then you can put that in with your garden and pots, plants. And the neat thing about that is that wool helps hold water. So it will hold water down in that soil. And then at the same time, that lanolin helps feed the plants. And then as the wool fibers actually biodegrade back into the soil, they also fertilize the plants. So it's a pretty neat process there. And then I said that it was mostly garden, but they're also starting to do trials even for crops.
And what would happen with crops, more of a widespread approach to using wool in crops?
Yeah, so still doing it as pellets right now. Mm-hmm. I think it's probably the easiest way to get it down into the soil. And so right now, one of the first trials it sounds like they're going to do is on potatoes. And so really doing it on a larger scale.
Okay, and perhaps even keeping moisture in the farmland, maybe it would reduce runoff. Heather, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Heather Pierce, Production Program Manager at the American Sheep Industry Association, and we continue this conversation about sheep wool fiber and its uses. You can call in with a question. Share your comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about sheep, wool, and fiber arts in Wisconsin and the shearing, the spinning, the weaving processes to make clothing and other items with wool. Call in with a question. Share comments. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Martha Bush is here, textile artist teaching classes in the Driftless area in Wisconsin and Minnesota. Martha, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's an honor to be here.
And Tammy Bowser is here as well, owner of Windridge Fiber Farm in Hollandale with a flock of about 60 ewes and more during lambing season. Tammy, welcome.
Hello. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, Tammy, let's start with you. You've been raising sheep for about two decades now. Why did you get into this niche business?
Well, it started with, I was at a garage sale and bought a floor loom for weaving, and I had no idea what I was doing. So I took a class, and then I thought, gee, I could produce my own wool for weaving, and it just kind of took off from there. And then I learned to spin, and it's kind of a rabbit hole.
It sounds like it spiraled, just like a growing ball of yarn, maybe.
Exactly.
Martha, you teach and you've been working with textiles, you know, for decades now. What is unique about working with wool as a textile?
I love felting wool, although I do lots of other things with wool too, but felting I think is my favorite because it is so plastic. It's so flexible. You can do so very many things with it. It's just a wonderful fiber material.
Very many things. Like what? Can you tell us about your works?
Well, I teach, and I'm a Waldorf teacher, and we use a lot of natural fibers. And so I make most of the puppets that I work with my parent-child classes out of wool. So I'm felting, you know, the Three Little Pigs or the Billy Goat's Gruff, or I'm doing There Was an Old Man with a Beard here this next week. And I make those puppets out of wool. Typically, I do needle felting, but sometimes they're also water felted, and I can elaborate on those processes if you're interested.
Yes, water felting. Help us understand what that is.
So I think that wool is one of the oldest, well, felting is one of the oldest textiles, and my theory is that some early person was walking along and was getting a blister in their shoe and saw a nice fluff of wool on a thorn and said, "Ooh, I'm going to put that in that sore spot." And when they got to their destination and took their shoes off by the fire, they looked down and that fluffy thing that they had plucked off the thorn was now really different. And it was squished together and had become a matted together piece of cloth. And that is the process of water felting. It's a chemical process where the little platelets of the fiber open up under heat and moisture, and then agitation, in this case, walking along with that little fluff in your shoe, causes the fibers to enmesh. And in the process that we do now, you would typically then rinse off the fiber, and that's going to close up those little platelets and cause everything to connect. So it's, you know, most people can relate to dreadlocks. Mm-hmm. Dreadlocks are basically felted. And that's the same basic thing that happens with animal wool as well. And then there's needle felting, which is the mechanical process where you use a needle. And this is, they use thousands of these needles in producing commercial felt. I think most people are familiar with this from school projects or Halloween costumes or something, that there are these thin, flat pieces of felt, and these days mostly made out of acrylic, but I prefer, obviously, wool felt. But the machine will put these needles, thousands and thousands of them all lined up, down through the fiber to enmesh them. Each needle has these tiny little barbs on it, and they grasp a hold of the fibers and stick them through each other until it is basically all matted together. And that is the process that creates felt mechanically on an industrial level. But as artists, we use those individual needles, and they come in different gauges or thicknesses, and sometimes they have different shapes, and that allows the wool to be felted together. But artistically, I love being able to use needles in felting because I can make very elaborate shapes. I can add different colors. I can build up large quantities and make something very sculptural.
Yeah, let the creativity run wild. Well, thank you so much for taking us through that process. You know, Tammy, why do you prefer to work with wool? What is the draw for you?
Well, I think, you know, kind of the same. It's very versatile. There are so many different fiber arts that wool can apply to, and wool blends too with other materials such as silk and other like alpaca and fibers. So it's just that I guess that ability to create so many different things with one item.
Mm-hmm. Well, Tammy, Sylvia emailed to ask about the wool conservation program, Shave 'em to Save 'em. That's the name of the program. Do you have any insights on what this program does?
I do. It's I'm part of that program. It's a program that the Livestock Conservancy runs, and the kind of the drive behind the program is there are lots of sheep breeds, and there are a lot of them that, because they haven't fit into the commercial molds, have kind of fallen by the wayside, and I'm sure we've lost many breeds, but there are people out there trying to conserve some of the heritage breeds. And in fact, I have Cotswolds, which are a threatened breed. And so their program, Shave 'em to Save 'em, is you get a passport book with different breeds in it. And each producer has stamps that if you purchase 4 ounces of wool from one of the breeds listed, then you get a stamp to fill your passport book. And then they have little prizes when you fill the passport book. So it's just a way to encourage people to try the different heritage breeds.
We're talking about wool with artists and entrepreneurs. That is Tammy Bowser. We have Martha Bush here. You can join in questions and comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. I want to talk a little bit more about the Cotswold, the breed that you have on your farm. Can you describe what they look like? I mean, this is a very large sheep from what I understand.
They are a larger breed, and they're considered a long wool breed, where in the sheep breeds, you have finer wools, which would be like the merinos. And then there are some that kind of fall in between, and finer being the crimp of the wool. Like merino has a very crimpy wool. The Cotswolds, being a long wool, they can grow up to 12 inches of wool in a year. And the crimp is very open. It's kind of more like really like a person's that has curly hair, kind of more like that. And generally they're white. There are a few black Cotswolds, And they have, as you can imagine, with, you know, 6 to 12 inches of wool on them, they're very woolly, and it hangs down in kind of ringlets, and they have wool on their face. So it looks like they have long bangs. So they're a very pretty sheep.
Let's take a call now. Brian joining us from Fort Atkinson. Brian, hello.
Hello. I was calling because I remember when I was a kid, I had to have some surgery on my left foot. And they had used some or given me some wool, and I had a wood-like shoe or thing that I was using for a shoe because of the surgery. But then they said like a piece of wool would make that a lot easier to walk with and stuff. Mm.
So wool, yeah, trying not to rub at the surgical site. Martha, it seems like a little bit about the story you told.
Yeah, it is a little bit like that. And that reminds me of, I'm of Potawatomi ancestry. And so I have wool inside my moccasins for a cushion. So it does definitely provide that softness and a little bit of layer of protection. Wool is an amazing fiber. It's very absorbent, you know, it keeps you warm even when it's wet. It's pretty amazing.
Is wool itchy? Some people complain about it being itchy. What are your thoughts on that, Martha?
Well, I think it has a lot to do with what Tammy was talking about. Sometimes people look for merino wool because it is a thinner fiber. And when you have longer fibers, the little pokey ends don't itch so much. So that can be a part of what makes wearing wool against the skin more comfortable. And also getting blends, like again, Tammy mentioned, maybe blending with silk, that can make things a lot softer if you're talking about, you know, a knitted garment, for example, or something like that. And the process of making yarn helps to draw those fibers along the length. And so that makes it less itchy.
Yeah. In drawing those fibers along, is spinning a difficult process for you?
I'm a terrible spinner. I have tried drop spindle spinning, and I'm really not very good at it. My daughter is a wonderful fiber artist in her own right. She is a knitter and makes all sorts of amazing things, but she is also a very capable spinner, and I've tried it, and I should really stick to felting because I am a terrible spinner.
Tammy, do you have any tips?
Yeah, I teach spinning classes. So really what I always tell people when they're first starting is get the wheel and just sit and treadle. So just use your foot, because you're trying to do two things at once when you're and your muscle memory isn't there yet. It's like, you know, rubbing your belly and patting your head when you're trying to make the wheel go in the right direction and trying to feed the wool in to get put the twist in it. So it's good to start with one part of it first and kind of get that down before you move on to the next step. But once you've got it, it's, you know, it's very relaxing. And the great thing about it is, because there are so many different breeds of sheep, you can, you know, if you go to the store to buy yarn, you're probably getting, in most cases, a merino or a superwash merino, where they've remove the scales from the fiber to make it softer. But there are so many other possibilities. And when you can spin your own, you can be very creative.
Tammy Bowser is owner of Windridge Fiber Farm in Iowa County. Martha Bush with us, textile artist in the Driftless region, teaching in Southwest Wisconsin. And as we discuss wool fiber, call in with a question. You can share your thoughts, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about the wool and fiber arts community in southwestern Wisconsin and the processes of shearing sheep and carding the wool, spinning it into yarn, weaving with it. Be part of the discussion. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Martha Bush is with us, textile artist teaching classes in the Driftless area. Tammy Bowser, owner of Windridge Fiber Farm, also in southwestern Wisconsin. Tammy, I want to take a moment to kind of learn about your flock. Like, what are the personalities of your ewes? Do you know them kind of personally?
Yes, I know them personally, and they all have names. So, and it is a wide variety of personalities. I have some sheep, such as Sweet Pea, who just would be very happy to curl up in your lap if you would let her and be scratched. And then there are others that are a little less interested in hands-on unless you've got a grain bucket in your hand, and then you're a very popular person.
Do they get into mischief?
Yes, they can, particularly when their shepherd forgets to maybe hook a gate or something, and then they like to roam and, you know, check things out. So,
have you found any attachment to certain sheep, or have you know, as the time goes on with them, learning more about their nuances?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I mentioned Sweet Pea because she's one of my. She was a bottle lamb back in the day, and so they tend to be much friendlier, and she's you know, she probably spent the first week of her house or of her life living in our house. So she's definitely
inside the
kind
house?
Of like the family dog.
Oh my goodness.
Pardon me?
Inside the house, roaming around in those first weeks of life?
Yes. You know, we often during lambing time, if we have a bottle lamb, I have some totes, and they need to be fed their bottles pretty frequently, and that's 24 hours a day. So rather than kind of being the lazy person and not feeling like going outside to give a bottle every couple hours during the night, they live in our mudroom in a tote, and then they have easy access.
What is lambing season like? How busy is it?
It can be really crazy. I think this year it should be pretty nice because we have wonderful weather. And actually, just any moment now, I could have my first lamb. Today is kind of the first due date. So, you know, sometimes it's pretty laid back and you have a lamb here and there. And then there are other times when they all decide that now would be a really good time. And you're trying to figure out which lamb belongs to which mom. And yeah, so it can kind of be a little bit of both crazy and laid back.
We heard from Anne in Appleton, sent along an email wondering, they have a lovely sheepskin that's become a bit matted. How do they care for it? They started to brush it, but it was getting frizzy and was losing some hair. Martha, any tips?
You know, that is a little bit complicated because you can pull out the hair if you're not careful. I have a lot of carding combs. I actually even do carding with toddlers. You can use the pet brushes that you can get that have an angled little comb to it. And if you are gentle, you can pull that. But I would maybe recommend for the sheepskin to use one of the wool wash products. They often have them with some of the lanolin in them that can clean the fleece without it becoming matted or felted. Mm-hmm. And that usually requires some soaking, but you also have to consider the skin itself on the back end. I don't know, Tammy might have some good recommendations on this too.
What do you think, Tammy?
Well, I know that some processors have create washable pelts, and others do not. So I think part of it would be figuring out whether it it is a washable pelt. And if so, I would definitely say using one of the wool washes and even like some conditioner would probably be helpful. But if it's not, I don't know, you know, that could also wreck it. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of hard to say.
Okay. Well, Tammy, you sell locks of wool that are hand dyed, Concord grape and forest floor colors. What are tips for dyeing wool at home?
I would say the first thing is safety. So you do want to like wear a mask when you're using the powdered dyes, because you certainly don't want those in your lungs. But other than that, it's just it's even mistakes can be fun mistakes. I sometimes have colors that just didn't quite go the way I had planned, and they turn out to be, you know, just wonderful new colors. So, you know, having your dyeing area, you don't want to use, if you're using commercial dyes anyway, you don't want to use just your regular pots and pans. You want to have items that are specifically for dyeing. But you can even get into it starting with things like Kool-Aid, and then that's perfectly safe. And that's something that you know, children can do as well. So, all those food coloring dyes can also make some really interesting colors.
Oh, kiddos could probably use the Kool-Aid. Martha, do you have any preferences for dyeing wool?
Actually, I was nodding along as Tammy was speaking. I tend to use the very accessible Kool-Aids and food colorings because protein fibers like wool, like silk, require an acid dye bath to dye properly. And vinegar can be that. And you can also use a microwave or your stovetop if you're using food grade dyes like food coloring and Kool-Aid, and just, you know, have a very successful time dyeing wool. I've also done it in the sun, in jars, and with vinegar and the coloration. I tend to use a very high saturation of food coloring or Kool-Aid, and then I think it's a 3-to-1 acid to water ratio. But yeah, I've had a lot of success. I do that in a number of classes.
Oh, well, this has been so much fun. Thank you both for joining us.
My pleasure. It's been great.
Oh, dear. That is Martha Bush, textile artist, teaching classes in the Deerfless area in Wisconsin and Minnesota. Tammy Bowser, owner of Windridge Fiber Farm in Hollandale, with those lambs on the way. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.